Then the showers and thunderstorms become more likely in the afternoon. The high Tuesday up to 90 degrees with south winds at 10 to 15 miles an hour. That threat of rain continuing into the evening, then a chance of lingering showers and thunderstorms after midnight tomorrow night into Wednesday. Tomorrow night's low 70. Then a cooling trend begins. Wednesday partly sunny with a high of 82 degrees, mostly cloudy and not as warm Wednesday night through Friday night, and then partly cloudy for the weekend, with Thursday and Friday's highs only in the lower 70s. Saturday and Sunday will be around 80 for highs. Wednesday night's low in the mid-60s. Thursday and Friday night's around 60. And Saturday night back into the low 60s for lows. Across the region right now in Decatur, we've got a cloudy sky and 79 degrees. A little bit of rain to the north in Bloomington where it was 71. And Peoria had 69 degrees, but still warmer elsewhere. Danville had 72, Rantoul 75, 83 in Mattoon, and 77 in Paris. At Willard Airport at the top of the hour, clouds in 76 degrees, relative humidity to 82%, the dew point a muggy 70, winds out of the east at 15, and 75 on the University of Illinois campus at 22 minutes before 1 o'clock. It's the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Tom Rogers. Farmers markets are growing in number and popularity. Initial research from the University of Illinois shows that consumers are shifting toward locally grown and produced food. More people are demanding it, and that means more vendors are rising to the occasion. Small businesses and farms are sprouting up across the state to meet the demand. But some of those culinary entrepreneurs say while the public's view of food is changing, government regulations have yet to catch up. Luke Runyon of Illinois Public Radio has this report.
I kind of like it in there. This is the first day she's decided to be a lap willy. I've had to make her be a lap willy every other day.
Vicki Bolliard is sitting on a small crate with a tiny black sheep curled in her lap.
Now she says, it's 100 degrees, I think I want to sit on you. Yeah, she's kind of a spoiled baby.
They're both under the cream-colored tent she puts up three times a week at farmers markets in Springfield. This little sheep is one of many from Bolliard's small farm near Taylorville, but the only one that makes the tri-weekly trek. Bolliard's owned her farm for 5 years now. Before that, she was a truck driver. Her business is growing, slowly. Laid out on the tables around her, lotions, moisturizers, bars of soap, all made with goat's milk. There's another wooden rack with some greens and veggies. She says she wants to do more and offer a wider selection of food, but certain health regulations have kept her from branching out.
You look in your cabinet, all right? You've got soap, you've got shampoo, you've got muscle rubs, Bengays, and things like that. We already offer those products. Well, now if we could offer your jams, your jellies, salsa, things like that that you normally use every day anyway. If you could get it, if you just know you could drive around your neighborhood and actually know somebody that makes these things. And I think that gives us an opportunity.
That opportunity is a piece of legislation passed by lawmakers last month. It essentially opens the gates to a growing business sector. It's being called the cottage food industry, and Bolliard says she wants to be a part of it. Right now, all packaged and prepared foods like those jams and salsas need to be made in a certified kitchen. That means bringing in a health inspector into the home kitchen and, if need be, make some big upgrades. That could include adding more sinks, plating counters in stainless steel, or adding more refrigerators. In other words, investments that are too costly for someone like Bolliard.
So if you've got a great recipe that you know is going to make it, but you don't have the ability or nor the desire, because there are loans available and things like that, but most of us really want to try to make it on our own.
And if Governor Pat Quinn signs new exemptions for small-time cooks into law, it doesn't completely cut out local health departments. People couldn't sell food that's prone to foodborne illness, like cream pies and cheese. It would only apply to breads, cookies, canned fruits, and dried teas. They'd be limited solely to farmers markets, and all the food would need to be labeled with a sticker saying it was prepared in a home kitchen which hasn't been thoroughly vetted by a health department. Bolliard's boyfriend, Thomas Vavrick, says that laissez-faire approach to farmers markets is better for customers and vendors. He works on the farm, taking care of the goats and picking produce.
We're not a bunch of goofballs just making stuff, and trying to make quick money. We have to put our face to these things, and we have to keep, repeating, making them good so that our customers and the people that want them come back.
The measure is a step towards the deregulation of the food industry, even if only a small step, and it was initially met with some resistance from health departments across the state. Greg Chance is the administrator for the Peoria City County Health Department. He says exceptions for small business need to be balanced, and some oversight is necessary, even in small home kitchens.
The key in public health and regulatory environment is preventing things from happening before they occur, not responding after they occur. And I would suggest most foodborne illnesses that we've seen in this state have originated facilities that have said, we would never do that. We know what we're doing. We know how to prevent foodborne illness.
But at the same time, Chance admits that some regulations aren't suited for small-time cooks looking to sell at farmers markets. The governor will now decide if the plan strikes a balance between growing small businesses and keeping the public safe. I'm Luke Runyon.
10 days ago, the U.S. Supreme Court decided whether fleeing from police is a violent felony. Interestingly, this is the fourth time since 2007 the court's been called to interpret the same clause of a Reagan-era anti-crime measure, and at least one justice is getting tired of it. Travis McNaid explains in this week's Legal Issues in the News.
Just after 11 one March night a few years ago, 30-year-old Marcus Sykes used a pistol during a botched carjacking in an Indianapolis liquor store parking lot. When one of his victims recognized him, he fled. But like a criminal in a hackneyed whodunit, he decided to return to the scene of the crime and was promptly arrested. This was not Sykes' first run-in with the law or handguns. 12 years earlier, he committed 2 robberies, also with a pistol, and stole a car. He spent 4 years in prison. A few years later, Sykes was driving down the road one night without his headlights on. When a police officer tried to pull him over, he stepped on the gas and led cops on a chase that toured the wrong side of the road, people crowded yards, a fence, and the back of a house. He returned to jail. After this latest botched stick-up, he was heading there again for what looked to be a maximum of 10 years. But Congress passed the Armed Career Criminal Act. It established a 15-year minimum for defendants convicted of unlawful possession of firearms who have 3 previous violent felony convictions. For Congress, a violent felony includes burglary, arson, and extortion. But the law also states that conduct that, quote, presents a serious potential risk of physical injury to another, unquote, is a violent felony. Sykes' sentencing judge found that his 2003 flight from police counted as just such a violent felony, qualifying him for this 15-year sentence. An appeals court agreed, and the case made its way to the Supreme Court for a final determination on this question. A 6-justice majority upheld the lower court opinion. Justice Kennedy noted that there was no question that Sykes' particular flight from police was violent. The question was whether, as a category, Sykes' behavior falls under the heading of violent felony. The court compared taking police on a chase with other of the enumerated crimes in Congress's short list. Quote, a criminal who takes flight and creates a risk of this dimension takes action similar in degree of danger to that involved in arson, which also entails intentional release of a destructive force dangerous to others, unquote. The majority opinion is perfectly justifiable. But what was interesting about this case was the makeup of the dissenters, 2 liberals and 1 conservative. Justice Kagan, in a dissent joined by Justice Ginsburg, attacked the majority's reasoning on a specific Indiana statute. She noted that vehicular flight in Indiana comes in varieties and is punished accordingly. Sykes was not convicted of aggravated, but rather simple vehicular flight, not involving aggressive or dangerous activity, and therefore was not guilty of a violent felony. But Justice Scalia attacked the Armed Career Criminal Act itself, noting that this was the 4th time in as many years that the court had to figure out what Congress meant with this one clause. The other crimes the court had to consider as violent felonies for the purposes of this act were attempted burglary, DUI, and failure to report to prison. Scalia declared enough already. The court should rule the clause void for vagueness. Quote, fuzzy, leave the details to be sorted out by the court's legislation is attractive to the congressman who wants credit for addressing a national problem, but does not have the time or perhaps the votes to grapple with the nitty-gritty. In the field of criminal law, at least, it is a time to call a halt. Unquote. In short, if Congress meant a car chase to qualify as a violent felony, it should have written as much into the act. In any event, Sykes will be out of jail by 2021, by which point the court, at its current pace, will have given us another 10 crimes that either do or do not qualify as violent felonies. So then he'll know for sure. I'm Travis McDade.
Travis McDade is the curator of Law Rare Books at the University of Illinois. You can hear Legal Issues in the News every Monday morning on Morning Edition, or you can listen live online or listen online anytime at will.illinois.edu. Well, we know birds use their songs to attract mates and fend off competitors. you might be surprised about some of the other animals of the non-human variety that use songs as part of the dating game. At least NPR's Joe Palca was.
Before this week, if you'd asked me if mice sing, I would have said, sure. I learned that from cartoons when I was growing up.
Mr. Trouble never hangs around when he hears this mighty sound. Here I come to save the day. That means that Mighty Mouse is on the way.
But am I the only one that was surprised to learn that real mice sing too?
It's not a well-known fact.
Brett Pash is a graduate student in animal behavior at the University of Florida.
The more we search, the more we find that rodents and other small mammals produce vocalizations.
The mice Pash studies are called Alston's singing mice. They're easy to find if you're willing to spend days on end crawling around in the cloud forests of Latin America. And here's what they sound like.
I can't hear anything.
That's my editor, Allison Richards. And you probably didn't hear anything either, since the song is at the high end of human hearing and is probably being obscured by other sounds around you. To make it easier for non-mice to hear, Pash has slowed the song down by 50% and lowered the frequency. Now try. Maybe not a Grammy winner, but apparently capable of evoking a female mouse's interest. Pash says it's mostly males that sing. In his studies, he changes the frequency and rate of this trill to see what has the most potent come-hither effect. One of those studies appears in the current issue of the journal Animal Behavior.
In this study, we manipulated the note rate.
He put female mice in a mouse-sized arena with two speakers at opposite ends. Then he played them male songs with different note rates or trill rates and watched what happened. And by the way, to all male mice listening to this broadcast, females prefer the faster trill.
Yeah, they approached the speakers that were emitting the faster trill. They approached that side more quickly and spent more time there.
Pash thinks the faster trillers probably have other qualities that make them better mate material. He says a lot of animals use songs to attract mates.
Birds and frogs and even in fish.
I'm sorry, did you say fish?
Yes, fish.
Sound production in fishes has been known for decades.
That's Andrew Bass. He studies sound production in fish at Cornell University.
You ever heard the names like drumfish or croakers?
Yeah.
That's how they got their names, because of the sounds they make.
Bass says fish make their sounds by vibrating the walls of an air-filled sac they have inside them called a swim bladder. And like singing mice, fish can modify their songs in a way that influences a female's behavior.
The calls, attributes of the call, clearly contribute to a female's decision whether to go to one male or the other.